It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickett will be back tomorrow. Coming up, a look at possible efforts to change Wisconsin's tax system. Governor Walker says we might be due for an overhaul. He pointed toward states with no income tax as a possible inspiration. First, a new report sets out to evaluate the overall health of Wisconsin and figure out differences by age, gender, ethnicity, and where we live. The overall grade is a B-, but behind that, there are a lot of details and a lot of people who are falling through the cracks in one way or another. Our guest is Karen Timberlake. She's director of the UW Population Health Institute, which issued the Health of Wisconsin Report Card for 2013. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good evening.
Thanks for joining us. And I want to focus a lot of our time on the disparities you found in this report. But first, looking at the big picture, overall, are we seeing health improvement in Wisconsin from year to year?
You know, it's really hard to say. We at the Population Health Institute have produced this report card three times now. We did the first version in 2007, then again in 2010, and again in 2013. And for overall health, we as a state are kind of stuck at a B minus. So, you know, we're doing better than some states with some groups of our population in terms of how long and how well people are living. But as you pointed out in the introduction, health is not the same for everyone all across our state. Not everybody has the same opportunity to live a long, healthy life, and we're seeing some of those inequities really show up in the numbers. And so that disparities grade, which looks at the magnitude of the difference between the healthiest groups and the least healthy groups, is also kind of stuck at a D.
And you mentioned living longer and living healthy, and that's your two main measures in this study. You broke down by age and a number of other factors how many people are dying, right?
Right.
That's the easy number to understand. How did you measure how well and how healthy we are?
Right, absolutely. And, you know, certainly it's important to understand much more than just the two measures that we have looked at for purposes of this report card. But in the spirit of keeping it simple and giving people something to focus on, right, we chose to look at death rates, what we might call the ultimate performance measure. So how many people of different life stages are dying. And then, as you said, we also are looking at what's called self-reported unhealthy days. So what does that mean? Every year, the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta works with states to do a telephone survey of people, adults all across the country of various ages. They're asked many, many questions about their health and health habits, smoking, drinking, how much they eat, how much they exercise, all that sort of thing. But one of the questions that people are asked is, in the past 30 days, how many of those days did you feel either physically unhealthy or mentally unhealthy? And it's really important to note that it's important to ask both those questions, because certainly physical health has a direct relationship to people's ability to go to work, go to school, care for children, be contributing members of society. But we're increasingly coming to really understand the close connection between mental health and physical health, certainly mental health in its own right, but also people with chronic diseases, for example, often will experience higher levels of depression and other kinds of mentally unhealthy days. And so when we want to understand at a given moment in time how well are people feeling in terms of data that we can get nationally, this is the best measure that we have available.
Well, delving into the findings and breaking down among groups, one thing that really leapt out at me when you broke down infant mortality rates, incredibly a lot higher for African Americans in Wisconsin. Can you talk about the differences you found there?
Absolutely. And, you know, for people who have been working in health improvement and public health, this is unfortunately not a new finding. But what we find is that for communities with significant African American populations in our state, so mostly in the southeastern part of the state, African American babies are about 3.5 times more likely to die prior to their first birthday than are white babies or Hispanic babies or Asian babies or babies of other races. Unfortunately for Native Americans in our state, they would be a close second to those elevated rates of infant mortality. Some of the best work that's being done on disparities in birth outcomes nationally is really looking at what's called a life course perspective. So we tend to think, well, is this a problem of access to prenatal care? Is this a problem of access to healthcare services in general? And that's a part of the picture, but what the leading scientists in this field are really finding is that the history of discrimination that many groups of racial and ethnic minority groups have experienced in our country, in particular African Americans and Native Americans, we're finding that the accumulated effects of that discrimination really builds up as stress in all people, but certainly in women. And those of us who have ever been pregnant know that stress creates these elevated levels of hormones that can create various kinds of birth issues, both pregnancy and birth issues. And we believe that that's what we're seeing as far as an effect for African Americans in our state.
Wow. So that's, I mean, in a way, you're fighting a few centuries of history. How do you tackle that in a public health outreach program?
So there really is some excellent work being done in Milwaukee, Racine, Kenosha, Beloit, communities that really have come to terms with this challenge and understand. You know, Bevan Baker, the health commissioner in the city of Milwaukee, will say that if there were the same number of murders happening in Milwaukee as African-American infant deaths, it would be front-page news all the time. And yet, you know, this is a somewhat invisible problem to many people. So that's one of the reasons we do a report card like this, is to raise the visibility. But there really are some excellent programs being done to really build awareness in the African-American community, to work with community leaders, to work with faith communities, to work with healthcare providers and others, to really help people understand that thinking about a healthy birth starts with thinking about healthy children who may eventually become pregnant women who choose to have babies. And so we actually have to start thinking about healthy birth outcomes by thinking about healthy early childhood development and healthy, you know, girls and young women, and make sure that they are best prepared for those healthy birth outcomes.
Wow. So that's what you mean by life cycle. Don't wait until you've got a woman who's pregnant right now, and that's the time to start with services. You're saying you're preparing for that at age one.
And it turns out that this idea of really focusing on infants and young children to set them up for success is an important strategy, certainly for improving birth outcomes, but it's also an important strategy for closing other kinds of gaps that we see in health outcomes. So we know, for example, that educational attainment, levels of formal education, did you finish high school, did you have some college, did you finish college, et cetera, how much education people have is highly, highly related to both how healthy they are while they're alive and quite literally how long they live. So people, organizations, groups that are working on helping children start kindergarten ready to learn are in no small way helping to work on helping those children live longer and healthier lives.
Another thing, if I'm reading the study right, turning to children and young adults now, geographically, the worst death rates you saw there were in rural counties in Wisconsin. Do I have that right?
You do, right.
And why is that?
Mm-hmm. So as we looked overall at those rates of death, what we do find is, as you point out, we see greater challenges for children in our rural areas than we do in suburban communities or in other parts of the state. And there are many potential causes for that. Certainly, one may be some of the higher risk factors that may be associated with living in more rural areas. So, for example, it's well documented and known that there can be higher risks to children in farm environments. Farming can be a very potentially risky activity for everyone involved in it, as well as for kids. And you know, certainly there, we also would have to ask some questions about equal access to healthcare services and other kinds of preventive services that those kids might need. So the purpose of the report card is really to cause people to ask those kinds of questions and to cause people who, for example, are community leaders in rural communities to not be satisfied with a statewide picture and don't take our word for it. It's important to go and look at local data and really understand if the same evidence is there locally of some challenges for, in this case, you know, children and their health.
We're talking to Karen Timberlake, director of the UW Population Health Institute, about a new report card on health in Wisconsin and differences and disparities among groups. You can join in and answer the question she just asked. What do you think we could do to be healthier in your community, in your part of Wisconsin, among you and people like you? Do you work in a healthcare field or do some kind of healthcare outreach? Or are you part of one of the communities we're talking about, African American or Native American, in Milwaukee or southeastern Wisconsin, or in a rural area? What are the obstacles to healthy living in your community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation now with Karen Timberlake with the UW Population Health Institute, talking about their new report card on health in our state and on disparities between different groups of people based on ethnicity, where we live, gender, that sort of thing. You can join in with your questions and tell us what is an obstacle to getting healthier, living longer, sweeter lives, as Zorba Pastor would say, in your community. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. We have Randy with us in Onalaska. Randy, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to say about health here in Wisconsin?
To me, it seems like I work for the Social Security Administration, and we take a lot of disability claims from people. Well, we see that a lot of inactivity, which creates, people that have diabetes, whatever stage. And it just seems like if you offer a program that encourages not only just eating healthy, but also being not athletic, but physical fitness. However you can move or do that, I think that would empower people to be healthier.
Randy, thanks a lot for the call. And Karen, I know maybe I'm thinking of other reports that I was looking at from the Population Health Institute. That's one of the health behaviors that you try to track. How are we doing on activity and exercise here in Wisconsin?
Right. It's really a great point that how long and how well we live is influenced by many factors, and one of them certainly is, do we get any kind of regular exercise? And speaking of Dr. Pastor, I love his comment about, look, we're not asking you to fall in with the jogging lobby that says you have to buy a certain kind of shoes and, do a certain kind of exercise. And I know he's famous for saying the best kind of exercise for you is whatever you will do. And so really, really want to compliment him for giving such a strong message. So one of the things we look at in another report, as you mentioned, is the percent of adults in Wisconsin, in the U.S., and in the nation that participated in any physical activity in the past month. And in Wisconsin, looks like that number is around 78% or so. So there's, again, as with everything, sort of a good news and opportunity picture there. So about three quarters of us have participated in some kind of physical activity in the past month, but pretty close to a quarter of adults in Wisconsin, when they were asked this question, said no, they did no kind of physical activity. So that could be gardening, that could be going for a walk in the neighborhood. Again, can be things that are very, very simple. So it's really important both to think about our own, personal choices and how we can work a little bit more physical activity into our day, but also to think about the neighborhoods we live in, the communities where we have our jobs, and how walkable, how bikeable, how conducive are those physical environments to helping us get out and move around a little bit.
Right, because we can tell people exercise all day, but if they think, my neighborhood isn't safe for my kids to walk in because of traffic or crime, that's not a helpful recommendation.
Exactly right. It's much easier to be healthy when you live in a healthy place. And there are many things that make a community healthy. We've talked about one of them, which is the ability to move your body and get out and move around. Another is access to healthy food. And it's an interesting exercise to think about how far you have to walk or drive to get to a full-service grocery store. There are many parts of our cities and our state and our rural communities where it's a long way between full-service grocery stores with affordable, healthy food, and that, again, creates a challenge for people. We can give advice about eating healthy all day, but if there is no grocery store nearby with a good selection of fresh food with prices you can afford, it's going to be hard for you to do that.
Thanks for bringing up those issues, Randy. We'll go back to the phones now. We have Susan with us in Edgerton. Susan, hi.
Hi. I'm a registered nurse, and I work at a small critical access hospital. And some of the things that I think are barriers for our patients is the fact that we have no public transportation. And so a lot of our patients are unable to drive. They can't afford a car or because of their health issues, so there's no public transportation. There's also a limited number of specialists who are willing to come to a rural community. And so for those patients, again, if they don't drive, they have a limited budget. It's difficult for them to get to a bigger place, a bigger city, a bigger facility that has specialists. And the other thing is, again, with the poverty medications, they choose to take their medications not as prescribed so that they last longer, or they don't fill their prescriptions at all because of their income. So those are a couple of my comments from a small community. Thank you.
Susan, thanks for sharing your experience. And Karen, a lot of obstacles there in rural Wisconsin.
Right. No, that's really a great firsthand account. On the transportation point, you know, one thing to think about, back to the discussion about both physically unhealthy days and mentally unhealthy days, one of the things we know is that social connectedness, you know, just the ability to be with other people, to participate in activities, to go to a community center or a town meeting or whatever it is so important, particularly as people age and may retire, separate from the workplace, other things they used to do that gave them a sense of belonging. And so Susan paints a really compelling picture. In some parts of our state, it's very hard for people who don't have cars, don't drive, can't afford a car, whatever it is, to be able to be connected to other people just by, through the simple means of having access to transportation that can get them places. So there are certainly many communities in our state that are working hard on improving that transportation infrastructure, and we think of it as having a sort of economic rationale, which it certainly does, but it also has a health rationale.
Thanks a lot for the call, Susan. We go now to Cindy in Milwaukee. Cindy, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Cindy from Milwaukee calling. I'm a registered dietitian and very proud graduate of UW-Madison's Department of Nutritional Sciences. So my question today, or my comment really, is in regards to ice skating. And just yesterday I had an experience in calling a Milwaukee County park and checking into ice skating for a family party we're having this weekend. And I drove by it on Sunday, and it hadn't been shoveled, and there were signs all over, dangerous, thin ice. And I thought, oh, my goodness, we got a problem here. So I called the people, and they said, well, all the county parks, the ice skating rinks have dangerous thin ice on them. I said, that's ridiculous because it's been so cold. It's clearly okay. I think the issue really is more liability. But when you're talking about, you know, exercise, childhood obesity, safety, recall when we were kids, my goodness, we had 3 ice skating rinks right within walking distance of our home. And during the winter months particularly, kids are just so plugged in. They just don't have an opportunity to do things even after dark that are supervised and healthy. And I would like to see more funds or more concentrated effort on ice skating for kids in the wintertime and families in general. That's outside.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. So more public exercise opportunities like ice skating. You can go beyond that if you want, Karen.
Sure. You know, I think Cindy makes a great point, which is so much of health improvement can happen locally. So just to her example, if the neighborhood around a couple of those rinks got together, or parks, and got together and got organized, you know, that, and talked to their alder people, et cetera, that's the way those kinds of changes happen. And, sometimes it's overwhelming to think about health improvement at an entire statewide level. So again, we produce statewide data so that we have a record of how we're doing as a state. But really what we want is for people to take ownership and get motivated to work on these issues locally, because that's where we can see some real change happen.
Just about out of time, but as I understand it, there's a goal to eliminate the disparity among groups in Wisconsin by, is it 2020 already?
Well, so the Healthiest Wisconsin State Health Plan, right, every 10 years the state produces a health plan that looks at wanting everyone to live better and longer. And one of the overarching goals of that plan is really to close the gaps between those who are doing well in our state and those who aren't doing so well. And the thing we need to understand is that health really occurs along a continuum. All of us can have opportunities to live longer and healthier lives. So if we create the conditions that will help those who are struggling with their health do better, we really create the conditions for us all to do better. So in some ways, we all do better when we all do better. And that's really the message that we hope people will take away from this report.
Karen, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Karen Timberlake, director of the UW Population Health Institute, talking about their new report card on Wisconsin's health. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the show, a topic for radio lovers. We'll find out why radio is an essential medium in developing countries. First, we take a look at income tax here in Wisconsin. Governor Walker has made it clear he wants to reform the state's tax code. And during an event yesterday, he said eliminating the state's income tax could be an option on the table. That got us thinking about the role income tax plays here in Wisconsin and what the state might look like without it. So we called up Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, to help us out. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me again.
Always glad to have you on. Can you talk, please, about the role income tax plays in our state budget? How much do we count on it?
Yeah. Well, it brought in about $7.5 billion last year. So that's over half of all the general fund expenditures. So it's the big boy at the state level. It should be said that gross property taxes are over $10 billion, so it's not the largest tax in the state, but for state government, it is by far. The sales tax comes in sort of a weak second at $4 to $5 billion.
A lot of that property tax goes straight into school districts, is that right?
Well, statewide, about 44% is schools, and then municipalities are about 23%, and counties and others follow after that.
Roughly, how much is your average Wisconsin resident paying in our income tax each year?
Well, I haven't thought of that lately. It's probably we see that there are a fair number of people that don't pay income taxes in Wisconsin just because it's a progressive tax. So those that do pay it, the averages are going to be a little higher. But I think for, you know, middle, upper middle kind of income people that are bearing the bulk of the state income tax, it could often be bigger than their property tax bill and, you know, certainly several thousands of dollars at minimum.
So a handful of other states, I think it's seven, don't have an income tax. What do they do?
Well, one is Washington, and it has a high sales tax. Another is New Hampshire, which doesn't have a state. Well, it has sort of an income, a small income tax. Doesn't have a sales tax. It does have a fairly high and very decentralized government that relies on property taxes. You know, some of the other states, Texas, I don't think has one, and they actually have a reasonably high property tax.
And Governor Walker, as I mentioned yesterday, said he spoke favorably of states without an income tax in the context of talking about changing our taxes in Wisconsin. I don't want to overinflate that to saying we're on the verge of getting rid of income tax, but what do you think in the next few years the possibility is that we might either shift it so that the income tax is less of a big deal or get rid of it altogether?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think some kind of shift is more likely than getting rid of it altogether. And the shift discussion would not be a new one. In fact, there are folks in Governor Walker's cabinet that talked about that very thing before the governor was elected. And the argument goes something like this. We rank high on income and property taxes. Both are about 25% or more above the national average. We have a lower sales tax, rank in the bottom 15, 16 states in the country. And so you could come up with some kind of solution that would try to balance those more so our income or property tax burdens would come in more toward the national average, and our sales tax burdens might be a little higher.
And the argument that has been made, and Governor Walker hinted, that lower income tax and shifting the burden would lead to a more productive economy, a better jobs environment in the state. But if we're just changing it all and not changing the net amount coming in, we can talk about that in a bit. Does the kind of tax we're paying really impact the economy?
Well, to some degree. I mean, economic theorists would suggest that if you want people to work harder and save more and invest more, that you don't want a tax on the income tax, and that we should, if we want people to spend less and be less wasteful, then maybe we should tax their consumption more. I mean, that's sort of a theoretical argument. But so, I mean, there's some sense to it. Really, the devil's in the detail. What happens if you have a very high sales tax to communities like Beloit, Platteville, La Crosse, Superior, et cetera, that sit on state borders? Do they suddenly experience a huge outflow of shoppers? Another issue is, if you get rid of the individual income tax, what do you do about the corporate income tax? Because what most people don't realize is that a majority of businesses, and that majority is growing rapidly, those businesses pay individual income taxes on their business income. They aren't paying traditional corporate income taxes. So if you get rid of business income taxes on one group but not on the other, what does that mean? I mean, it's sort of discriminatory. So there's all sorts of technical issues like this. You know, if you deduct the state income tax on your federal income tax and don't have that to deduct anymore, what happens? Do you end up sending a lot more to the feds?
And the governor mentioned, if they start opening up the hood here and changing our taxes, one of the goals would be to reduce the overall burden. So wherever they end up, the net amount that people would pay, and I guess that the state government takes in, would go down a little.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that as being likely?
Well, it becomes more likely depending on choices one is willing to make. We have a state government whose spending in normal times has been growing 3-4% a year, so you're going to have to find some way to either slow that or stop that or turn it the other way. And you know, state government budgets haven't been exactly easy the last 5 or 10 years, so everybody's been on a diet for a pretty long time.
Do you think, Todd, that that Wisconsin's tax system needs a revisit, a revamp, either a light makeover or a complete overhaul?
Well, clearly, when you've got a tax system that is out of balance, such as ours, with a high property tax and a high individual income tax, there's something to be said for rethinking it. Even if that were not true, governors and legislators of both parties love to curry favor with constituents and lobbyists by, I guess to put it bluntly, junking up tax law with lots of deductions and credits and exemptions and breaks. And it is good once in a while to sort of clean out the underbrush and get a simpler, more understandable tax law, because tax law is regulation too. You don't want people to be wasting a lot of time complying with tax law.
I'll make a massive understatement here. Our tax system, changing it is going to be complicated.
It's very complicated. And to be honest, the last couple of years, the budget choices that have been made probably haven't made tax reform easier, because you really need sort of a pot of money to ease the transition, if you will. I mean, there are winners and losers in these kinds of big changes, and you want to have a pot of money to help with that. But we are in the process in this state budget of spending down a fairly large surplus. So by the end of this budget period, as we go into the next one, we're not going to have a lot of spare cash around, unless the economy does a little better.
And most likely these things are not going to happen between now and next year's election. Is that right?
They are not going to happen. which is why you probably haven't heard anybody talking about it in the context of running for re-election.
Todd, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's Todd Barry. He's president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. When television became commercially available in the 1920s, some predicted the end of radio. Well, here we are, almost a century later, still going strong. Some people have referred lately to the popularity of public radio and podcasts as a new golden age for the medium. Today, though, we might think of radio as a secondary source of info behind the internet or maybe television. In less industrial developed parts of the world, though, radio can be a vital source of information, in some places, the main source. Global health reporter Sarika Bansal joins us now to share how this works in Africa. Her piece, In Tanzania, Farmers Reap the Benefits of Radio, appeared in the New York Times blog called Opinionator. She's here with us now. Sarika, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So you wrote about Africa, but in particular, you visited Tanzania. Can you talk about the kind of communities that you visited that rely so strongly on radio? Apart from radio, how connected are they to the rest of their country and the world?
So Tanzania is 75% of the population is rural, so they're not nearly as connected as populations in the United States, for example. And roads, and especially good roads, are pretty hard to come by. Electricity is also pretty scarce, so I learned that radio, and especially wind-up radio, is a pretty good way of reaching people.
And I keep seeing things about a mobile boom across the continent of Africa, with mobile phones in particular, but that hasn't reached the areas you're talking about as strongly as elsewhere, it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a growth, but it's still growing off of a pretty low base. And I think about 40% of Tanzania is still not entirely on the mobile grid. So you have, I mean, I was in a lot of places with either very poor or no mobile connectivity at all. So farmers, I mean, the way they would get information from each other, and they're mostly farmers we're talking about, the way they would get information was either face-to-face with people or from the radio.
So let's talk about the radio. Why does that work so well for people in these isolated environments?
Sure. So I think one reason it works so well is because it's available. About 90% of farmers in Tanzania have access and pretty good access to the radio. And I think another reason it works well is because a lot of people told me about how Tanzania in particular, and I think this is true with a lot of sub-Saharan African countries, has a very rich storytelling culture. So people are used to hearing other people's stories and telling their own, sharing their own thoughts. So I think it just fits very well with how people communicate anyway.
Let's get into how they're using the radio. A lot of what you talk about is farming education. We'd call it extension here in Wisconsin. What kind of things are people learning about agriculture through their radios?
That's right. Yeah, and I think a lot of people actually use the same phrase in Tanzania, so it was potentially borrowed from Wisconsin. Who knows? So one of the things that people use the radio for are like very basic crop price information and just understanding, you know, weather patterns and whatnot. But beyond that, a lot of people are using radio to understand, to learn about new techniques in farming, new innovations that they can use in terms of planting, like different modes of planting tomatoes that they may not have known about before, new crops that they could use. I listened to a show on kitchen farming, so what kind of plants and whatnot could you farm right near your home? So it was a variety of things.
And do people have their own wind-up radios, or do they all gather together during showtime to listen?
It was a mix of both that I saw. So some families, especially those that were a bit better off, had their own radios. And people use radio not just for getting information, but also for listening to music. And there are a lot of Christian radio stations, for example. So, you know, instead of going to church, they can just listen right at home. And a lot of other people I saw did gather around and listen. And actually, there's this group that I profiled in my piece called Farm Radio International, and they supported what they call listening groups. And about 20 or so farmers, they would get together, and they would listen to the broadcast on farming together and then just talk about what they heard and how they could apply that in their own lives.
And that group, radio is appealing to them, I gather, because it's cheap as a as an outreach method. It's available, and not everyone they're targeting is necessarily literate. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the you know, handing out pamphlets to people, unless they have a lot of pictures on them, isn't really necessarily the best way to reach people. They found that, exactly as you said, that audio sticks with people a lot more. And specifically with the listening group, they found that getting people to be able to talk about these different innovations after hearing about them and potentially using some of them in their own lives, that's a really good way of getting people to experiment and do things that are maybe outside their comfort zone otherwise.
And meeting with farmers, what kind of changes did you see them making based on what they'd heard over the radio and then maybe talked about with their listening group afterward?
So one change that I saw was just in a couple of new crops that were growing. People were growing different types of greens that they weren't otherwise, and different types of herbs. There's one farmer who's using some different organic methods to, instead of using regular pesticides, where he was instead using some organic pesticides. So, and those were all changes that they attributed to what they heard on the radio.
Can you introduce us to the personalities, my alter egos on these Tanzanian radio stations? What kind of people are running the broadcasts there?
You know, they're people with pretty similar. I was surprised at how similar they were to people who I've met in the U.S. who work on the radio. I mean, they're people who just care about storytelling. A lot of these stations that I visited were very community-based. So there is one radio jockey named Clara Moita in particular, and she had been working in this radio station for about 4 years and knew pretty much everyone and all of the farmers in her community. So when she was speaking about farming on the radio, she was able to point to specific people as examples.
And do they do, now I know not everyone has phones available, but there is some mobile penetration there. Do they have, and this is another one close to my heart, call-in shows?
Yes, yes. And that is, and that's another thing that, and there's been a little bit of research on this, but people have found that to be really useful, that, you know, not just, we think of radio often as just a one-way communication tool, that it's just, you know, something that's being told on the radio is going out to listeners and the listeners can do what they want. But they found that, you know, that by introducing this element of interactivity, whether it's by call-in shows, some of them had also introduced SMSing. So basically, people can text in answers to quizzes if they, again, have access to mobile technology. So they had done that, and it seemed like that really enhanced people's learning.
And
for people who don't have mobile phones, some of them who had the wind-up radio, they had specific types of wind-up radio that they were selling around different communities that recorded voice, and someone could come around and pick up the radio and specifically pick up the tape in which that voice was recorded, and part of the farmer's conversation could appear on the air a few days later.
Oh, no kidding. So if I'm the farmer, I can be listening along in my wind-up. When the show's over, I switch over to record and recount my experience or maybe my question or something like that, and then listen in a couple days later, and I'll show up there.
Yeah, that's exactly right, which I think is a really cool way of getting farmers' voices heard. That was another thing that people kept telling me, that, you know, farmers don't want to hear from, you know, some expert sitting in an academic chair millions of miles away. Farmers want to hear from other farmers. Like, that's who they really, really trust. So if another farmer is telling them, like, hey, I tried this new technique for planting cucumbers, and my bushes this season are, you know, 1.5 times the size they were last season, there's a higher chance that others will, you know, actually think of doing it themselves.
So it's social networking via radio in a way.
Yeah, it's like Facebook for farmers.
Great. Well, you went to Tanzania, but that's not the only place this is going on. How widespread are these radio programs now?
These radio programs are very widespread across Africa. So this group that I talk about in my piece, Farm Radio International, they run 38 radio stations that are this intensive, as I just described, across 7 countries. But they also provide radio content to almost 500 stations around the continent, to almost every country in Africa.
And are you going to go back, do you think, and check out some of the other programs around the continent?
I would love to, yeah. I think that just the idea of farmers getting information in a pretty, I mean, it seems like a low-tech way, but it's, you know, very sophisticated thinking that goes behind it. I think that that's incredibly exciting.
Interesting. Sarika, thank you so much for joining us today. Very, very interesting reporting on that.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Sarika Bansal, global health reporter. Her article is called In Tanzania, Farmers Reap the Benefits of Radio. It appeared on the New York Times online blog, Opinionator. Well, I'd like you to share something maybe you've learned on the radio, ideally here on Wisconsin Public Radio or maybe somewhere else. You can email us now at talk@WPR.org or head over to the Central Time Facebook page. We're Central Time on WPR or Twitter. Always looking for more people to communicate with us via Twitter. We are Central Time WPR there. The question, what is something you've learned from Wisconsin Public Radio or elsewhere on the radio? Look forward to hearing what you have to say there.